Basically, in order to understand why that's become an issue, you have to look back at a little bit of the framing of the whole thing, the context within which this argument's taking place. And that has to do with the history of electricity. Electricity is only 130 years old. And in the early days, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, electricity was extremely capital intensive. In other words, to build, it required huge construction. Dams were originally the source, and big coal power plants and transmission facilities. And so those, the cost was about $3 to $4 for every dollar of revenue. So, and it was there were thousands of power companies back at the turn of the century. So they created a new system of monopolies, which was created, it started in 1907 by the Edison companies, and which was actually at that time owned by J.P. Morgan, not Edison anymore. But they created this system of monopolies throughout all the states, and to guarantee reliable power in exchange for guaranteed high rates of return for those companies. So the business model they developed over that 100 years was basically based on two things: selling kilowatt hours of electricity to their customers at a guaranteed price, and also, more importantly, getting 10 to 12% return on capital construction, capital assets that they built, generation and transmission assets. Okay, well, we fast forward to today and the advent of solar power. That economy of scale, you can't build a small nuclear power plant. It's hard to build a small dam in your backyard. It's hard to build a small coal plant. But solar panels are just as efficient at small scale as they at large. In other words, the productivity of solar depends entirely on the number of square inches of the panel. And so that economy of scale has been basically gone away. And that's where the debate is today, because there's differential costs that have to do with the cost of capital, is what they call soft costs, which are installation costs and all the many different costs associated with any kind of installation. And so this report that we were talking about that was written by the Brattle Group on behalf of First Solar and Xcel Energy and the Edison Electric Institute is basically to justify continuing that old business model of capital construction and return on capital assets and maintaining control of the electricity flow, because these are huge companies with huge assets and lots of investors. And if people can generate power on their roof and they maybe have a battery in their basement or something like that, and maybe if they trade power, it would only be with their next door neighbor or in their neighborhood, which is quite feasible with solar. Who needs the power company anymore? And so this was written up, a threat that has emerged in the last 3 years. The Edison Electric Institute produced a report just 2 years ago called Disruptive Challenges. And that was what this was about. It was basically alerting the industry that the Edison Electric Institute serves, the electric power industry, that their business model was not going to continue to work, and that they had to find a different business model or a way to make money in the future that's not based on that return on capital.
Is there a third option? Because it seems that now, as the solar market is emerging, we're seeing big solar, utility scale solar versus small scale rooftop solar. I know that there's maybe the mama bear option, the one in the middle, that's a community garden and community solar gardens, in which case you have a much smaller model, but it's not based on that individual, I have to have a battery in my basement connected to my rooftop solar panel. I mean, how does that issue around solar gardens and a much smaller community scale fit into this whole model?
That's a very good question. And what I call community solar or solar gardens could be definitely clusters of the placing of solar arrays in places where, not everybody can put them on the roof. I have that problem myself. My house faces the wrong way. There's trees that shade it. And I have neighbors with the same problem. But what they've done is invest in a solar garden, which is, they still get the tax benefits and they get the net metering revenues and the cost savings and the environmental benefits without having to have it on their own roof. But, that's a good model, and that's a model that we're going to see more and more of. I just wrote another report, actually a four-page article that was published in the latest issue of Solar Today, called Community Solar, the Utility of the Future. And it's about Boulder, Colorado, and the efforts in the city of Boulder to move to this model. By getting control of the utility, their right to make their own power here. And the basic concept is that the power should be used, or the economics of it are that the power, the electricity, should be produced as close to where it's used as possible. And that way you don't have all the inefficiencies of these large remote facilities or solar farms.
And then the distribution is, of course, smaller.
If you can keep the generation within the local distribution grid at the lower voltages, you're not losing all that power. And a solar garden placed within the community is a good idea because it can do that. It can just act as if it's another house or a business. But there's no reason, recent studies have shown conducted by NREL on behalf of the city of Boulder, a very recent study using what I call LIDAR technology to map all the available roof space in the city. We found that we have three times the capacity of available roof space than what we need to run the city, the entire energy requirements of the city of Boulder.
What do you think that this argument that seems to be emerging, pitting big solar against small solar, whether it's on an individual basis, a rooftop solar or a community garden, that this narrative that's emerging, that this study by the Brattle Group is looking at the cost comparison between the two. I mean, what does that ultimately do for the overall discussion around moving towards renewable energy? Is it a distraction or are there real consequences to this?
Well, I think that the report certainly deserves attention, and the issues that it mentions need to be addressed. As I said, what they've done in this report, the report is written to really try to shine the best light as possible on a very difficult situation for them, because the economics of their industry are going away, and they've done a good job for now of making it look attractive by narrowing the scope of their study. And for instance, they don't discuss transmission costs. They don't talk about environmental costs whatsoever. They exclude those as externalities or what they call non-monetized costs. So they say, well, that's beyond the scope of this report. Yeah, of course. But those are important issues. And that's what motivating, in fact, most of the people in Boulder that I know are motivated by those what they consider non-monetized costs, the environmental issues involved.
So as people are becoming more aware of where their energy is coming from, if you are with a large utility like Xcel, you can choose whether it's coming from wind energy or you have the option to maybe have solar panels or participate in a solar garden. Is this important if you feel that, okay, well, I'm going down the right path because I'm choosing renewable energy, but now do we also have to have the conversation, well, what kind of renewable energy? Am I still with the big utility? There are hidden costs with that, even if they are renewable energies, or do I need to look at, supporting a more localized form of energy production?
You can see, to answer that question, you can look at the three most difficult places in the United States right now. The worst case is Hawaii, where the cost of electricity are three times what they are here, because they generated in the past they had the centralized generation model, but they ran on diesel fuel that they had to import, and so it's a ridiculous cost. And so everyone in Hawaii that could afford to put solar panels on their house was doing it, and that drove up the solar production to the point where if solar reaches over about 12 to 15% of the power going into the grid is coming from solar in a net metering situation, which means you can run your meter backward. You feed power from your house into the grid when it's convenient to you. But the trouble is the grid can't stand that. And then who provides the power at night? So you have too much power part of the time and not enough other parts of the time. So the utility, which was based on this traditional model, was caught in a bind. And so they've had to reinvent that whole utility and their business model, and it's in total chaos. The solution is to buy more batteries and put them in the grid or put them in people's houses and to flatten that production curve so that you're they're delivering power more evenly when it's needed, not just when it's available. But Hawaii is a very small state. The real situation is New York State right now, which has, other than Hawaii, the highest electric rates in the country. And the reason that those rates are so high is because the utility industry has gone on a spending binge, building more and more transmission. And as people start generating solar locally, or either on their roofs or in solar gardens, they don't need as much of the the centralized generation anymore. But the utilities can only make money two ways: selling you power. If they can't sell you power, they can build power. They can build transmission lines and sell you those and collect the 12% return that they get in New York on that. And that's driven the costs up to the highest in the country for New York. And so it's reached a breaking point. And it got worse when they had this huge superstorm Sandy that really brought down a lot of the power grid and exposed the vulnerabilities of centralized generation and transmission. So a lot of communities, including all of Lower Manhattan, was out of power for nearly a week. And it was a shocker. What they've done is they're rethinking the whole thing and saying, wait a minute, we don't need all this transmission anymore. Why don't we just generate the power where we're using it?
I'm speaking with Tim Sheckley. He's written a recent article a report that has appeared in the latest edition of Solar Today. It's on community solar, the utility of the future. In many ways, it's a rebuttal to a study that was released recently by a Massachusetts-based Brattle group that looked at utility-scale solar and compared that in terms of price to residential and small-scale solar. In terms of how we're pricing electricity, and you touched on this earlier in terms of the historical context about the big power utility plants and what have you. Do we need to completely restructure how we're pricing and charging for utility? Because the current model that we have is so much entrenched in that old model where the big power plants were being built with this huge economics of scale, and that made sense. But now maybe with new renewable energies and the ability to generate energy much more locally, that turns a lot of that on its head. I mean, do we need to have a complete rethink of just how all of this is priced and how consumers are charged?
Well, that's a really good question. In fact, that happens to be my focus of interest right now. In fact, this morning I was on a one-hour teleconference webinar with a group from the Department of Energy and the Smart Grid Interoperability Panel on the topic of transactive energy. The answer to your question is basically a whole new rate structure. And in other words, a way of pricing electricity that doesn't have to do with the fixed costs of traditional generation and transmission, but has more to do with what's being produced in real time on the grid and balancing the supply and demand of energy locally within the distribution grid. So this seminar was about this new concept called transactive energy. Transactive energy is just a term that's just emerged in the last few years, but it has to do with saying that to control an electric grid or any system, you can, instead of having what's called traditional command control, where you have a central computer that's sending orders, turn this on, turn that off, and so forth, centralized controls, you have what's called a transactive control. In other words, the control is based on an exchange of value or an exchange of benefit between the parties, and the producers and the producers and the users. And every user could also be a producer depending on the time of day. So it's a system of trading. And this technology is new. It was tested. Some early trials were done in the Pacific Northwest, sponsored by the Department of Energy and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, and they showed a lot of promise. And it's been actually used on a trial basis even today in the Pacific Northwest in special DOE sponsored tests. But it isn't real yet. It isn't to the point where we can say here's a tariff based on transactive energy that we can roll out to the local, in the local grid. But what I think there's an opportunity, if Boulder is able to go forward with municipalizing its power grid, it will have the opportunity to use some of these new technologies. In fact, then, and if some communities can use them and prove that they work, then all of the state's public utilities commissions can adopt these transactive tariffs instead of conventional tariffs. And of course, a transactive tariff is not perfect. It has to be it has to be carefully, very carefully designed and tested. It's not something that's out of the box yet.
When you get your utility bill, whether it's Xcel, whether it's gas, whether I live in Longmont, so my electricity comes through the municipality, the municipal bill. When I'm looking at what I'm paying for, how much of that is reflective of the energy that I'm using and how much is reflective of the infrastructure, the projected costs of building either new power plants or new transmission lines? I mean, how much of the current energy bills that consumers get is really reflective of the actual energy they're consuming?
Well, you know, that actually varies from place to place, but it's probably less than half of the cost of your bill is what the fuel costs are, and the type of production. And if you're using solar energy or wind energy, the fuel cost is zero. Zero is a hard number to beat, and that's the direction things are moving. There's some reports that address this issue about costs. In fact, I'd say over the last 6 to 9 months, every major investment bank in the world has issued a report on this topic about the future of solar, and also the International Energy Agency. And I have just prepared a paper on Hudson Valley and New York State issues there, which I cited many of these reports. That was done for an environmental group in New York to show that they didn't need to build a new transmission line, that they had plenty of local power that they could use and plenty of opportunities to reduce that cost. But I'd say more than half of the cost, well over half of the cost, associated with the infrastructure, the capital construction. And in New York, it's even worse than anywhere else. For instance, the price in New York, the price of natural gas over the last 3 years dropped 39%, but the cost of electricity went up 39%.
If I could extrapolate from what you're just saying there, if communities, therefore, were to move towards more localized energy production, you would have a lot less costs then, surely, because you've got less transmission, you've got less infrastructure to build. Do you think then that would translate into lower bills just on that basis alone?
Well, I think absolutely that would be true. In fact, ideally, if you make the capital investment, if the people make the capital investment to generate their own electricity, you know, in situ or within the community, let's say, the only cost is going to be maintaining those wires and poles to trade that power locally. You don't have any big transmission lines coming in. You won't be buying power from some remote generator. You would just maybe be swapping it locally. It'd be more like internet access. You pay a monthly fee for wire maintenance and billing services, and that's really what it boils down to. That's, I think, the direction that it's going, and the economics are going to drive this. I think that a report like this is the title of the report is Comparative Generation Costs of Utility Scale and Residential Scale PV and Xcel Energy's Service Area, Colorado Service Area. I think that's a heroic effort on their part, but to fend off the future, but it's not going to work.
Is this argument, and maybe it's a false argument or a false narrative, going to continue, do you think, as large utilities are making that inevitable move towards renewables, that we're going to see this discussion about the cost effectiveness of a utility scale, fill in the blank, you know,
yes,
energy production versus local community-based ones?
Yeah, and that is, we're going to see that happen. It's inevitable. It's driven by the economics of solar and battery storage, because the complaint of solar has always been, well, it's variable. It's variable. It doesn't do anything at night. Well, if it turns out if you put some batteries with that, it works fine. And if you it doesn't take a whole lot of batteries. In fact, if you match the amount of money you invest with the solar panels with a battery bank, and the batteries are getting cheaper and the solar panels are getting cheaper and the inverters are getting cheaper, I think that that's going to cross the point where it's there's no question about it. The economics are there. So let's see, something else that we're going to say about that.
I guess the point I was trying to get at is, are we going to see more and more of this coming from large utility companies as they make what seems to be an inevitable transition?
Well, I think the utility companies are in a bind, and there's no clear benefit or no clear path for them. And this was laid out in the Disruptive Challenges report from the Edison Electric Institute 3 years ago that said, or 2 or 3 years ago, that said, your business model isn't going to work anymore with distributed the economics of distributed solar and wind, and so you need to do a couple. You need to either, you can just fight it, and use political clout to fend it off, or you can adapt your business model to a new business model that's a service model. In other words, maintaining the wires and poles and let the customers generate the power. That's where it's headed. They laid that in the report, and the utilities so far. You know, it's very hard to change their business model. These are huge organizations, and they've got a lot of investors. And the new business model, the service model, is never going to be quite as profitable as that 10 to 12% return on capital that was given to them back in 1907. And that's just not, that's gone away. It's just happened. It's happened in other parts of our economy already. It happened in electronics and computing, and we saw, you know, this you're happening to have, it's happening everywhere from hotels to taxi cabs now. It's the information technology and technology in general is bypassing a lot of that infrastructure that used to be needed.
I'm speaking with Tim Sheckley. He's written a recent article that a report that has appeared in the latest edition of Solar Today. It's on community solar, the utility of the future. In many ways, it's a rebuttal to a study that was released recently by a Massachusetts-based Brattle group that looked at utility-scale solar and compared that in terms of price to residential and small-scale solar. Tim Sheckley is saying that many externalities, cost externalities, were not accurate in that, and that we need to look at a whole variety of different aspects of this, including the entire structure of how we price energy. Given that what you're saying is that we need to completely rethink the economics of pricing energy, can we look to other countries who have done it? I mean, are we seeing this pricing model really in operation anywhere else?
Well, nobody has really solved the pricing model yet. The country that's pioneered this solar energy and renewable energy in general is Germany, and they did it through sheer willpower. They had decided, for a number of reasons, political and economic reasons and social reasons, that they did not want nuclear power. They did not want coal or pollution, and they were concerned about global warming, and they needed to go to renewable, and solar was one of the most obvious choices. And so they implemented a system of feed-in tariffs, which that means a fixed rate that you get. If you put solar on your panel, you put basically putting a power plant on your roof, and you get paid for it at a very nice rate, a declining very high initially a rate of return. And so that made every citizen into a power producer. That was successful, but the problem is that they didn't have the battery technology to back that up, and it also, they had to give a lot of favorable treatment to certain industries because they didn't want to kill the industry, so their industrial base. So it created a lot of turmoil, but it has been very successful overall. And what it did was get the Chinese to start learning how to make cheap solar panels, and they, of course, have run a circle around them, and now they're going to run a circle around us, because they can make electronics, they can make the solar panels, and they can make the batteries, too. So I think in the long run, they'll benefit. Everybody will benefit.
Tim, are we going to see some of this happen with other renewable energy, whether it's wind? Are we going to see big industrial utility scale wind production versus small wind production? Or is solar very unique because of the capacity to have just solar panels on your rooftop?
Well, the same thing is true to a certain extent for wind, although not quite as much as solar. Since a solar panel is essentially very simple, it's not simple from a physics standpoint, but it is simple from a manufacturing and installation standpoint. It's just a flat piece of panel, and it produces power. It's got no moving parts. Wind has actually that scalable quality to a large extent. A large windmill is not particularly more efficient than a small one. It's just that the manufacturing, you know, it's basically a manufacturing problem, just like solar panels. It's like making washing machines. Making windmills is like making any kind of manufactured product. Large wind farms are not better than distributed wind. It's just that they also have the same issues around transmission too. The trouble is it's the technology at a small scale is not as advanced as it is at a large scale.
But the technology for small scale solar production
is advanced. Now there are research groups like at Caltech, people like that working on small scale wind and technologies for making smaller, cheaper windmills that can be placed in urban areas and all kinds of environments. But that isn't as developed. That's a mechanical task that hasn't been done yet. But the same issues apply in terms of the economy of scale industry's accustomed to with nuclear, big hydro and big coal plants is gone away.
All of this is happening in the context as well, of course, of President Obama's recent announcement on the climate plan and how we need to reduce emissions. Of course, Colorado is already exceeding what is being laid out. Many people, of course, saying it's a very, very low bar for us to even hop over in terms of getting away from fossil fuels. But do you see the future of renewable energies really? An essential part of that is restructuring and rethinking and reevaluating how we price the entire thing, given, as you were saying earlier, the whole context of how we pay for energy right now. It's so tied to big, big carbon emitting fossil fuel energy with the big power plants and the transmission and everything.
Right. And part of that is that, and you can see it in this report, because one of the big differentials they
This is the Brattle report.
The Brattle report.
Shows that large-scale utility solar panels or solar power, they're saying, is cheaper than
A large part of their argument depends on how it's financed. They say, well, the dominant model right now is leasing. Leasing is pretty expensive. Now, if you bought it yourself or you bank it, or buy it with conventional financing, it's cheaper. In fact, if you don't consider the financing costs, the big differential drops by a third or a half of what they say in here, and they admit that. There's a graph in here that shows that. But I guess you have to consider the fact that these big power plants are big power projects and transmission lines are financed through bonds. Big bond deals, bond traders, Wall Street bankers, and there's a huge infrastructure built around financing this stuff. As I said, since the early days, $3 or $4 of investment was required for a dollar of revenue. But with the small scale, how do people finance solar panels on the roof? They're getting cheap enough now, so you can put it on a credit card, or you can. There are a lot of solar. What is it? Solar City coming around saying we'll finance the whole thing if you want to lease it, or we'll give you options as to how to finance it, or you can put it on. You can get a loan from the credit union or a bank. I mean, it's like how you would buy a new washing machine or buy a new car, even. I mean, it's not like this billion-dollar power plant down in Pueblo.
Tim Sheckley is the author of Community Solar, Utility of the Future. It's a new report that's published in the latest edition of Solar Today. We'll link to that at our website, kgnu.org/apublicaffair. We'll also link to the study done by the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based Brattle Group that looked at the cost of solar energy being produced by utility scale solar versus smaller scale. And you can find out more about all of this at our website, kgnu.org/apublicaffair. Tim Sheckley, thank you very much.